Welcome to Comics,
episode
247.
This week, we talk about
Southern Bastards.
Visit us at welcometocomics.com. Listen to past episodes, see what we're reading next, send us a message, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. This episode is supported by listeners like you. Go to patreon.com/welcometocomics. And now,
the cast begins.
Looks like we're going to proceed without him and his ball of hate.
Well, this is what he gets for naming his child after a Klingon.
That's definitely the reason.
Well, you can't expect the kid to not be stubborn.
Mm-mm.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I don't know, everything still shapes and colors at that point, so you're whiny like nobody's business.
Ah, babies. Don't even know.
I like them once you don't have to clean them anymore. Once they can take care of themselves, they're fine.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for that day.
I don't know, just wait like 30 years or so. You'll be good.
Then you have them clean you. Circle of life.
I just want you to know the opening of The Lion King just played in my head.
Oh, because circle of life, I get it. So, anyways, we read a comic book this week.
This week's comic.
Four issues in particular. It was four issues, right? Only?
Yeah, only four. Apparently they're 12 out, but they're very slow in producing them, which I think fits this one a lot.
Well, I think that makes sense, too, because Jason Aaron also writes... I think he writes the Darth Vader comic or the Star Wars comic. I forget which one. I think he writes Star Wars. I think Kieran Gillen, I don't know how to pronounce his last name.
Oh, okay. Wait, so not the one from Doctor Who and NTSF, right? No, that was a serious question. I don't know.
Not Kieran. His name was like Kieran. He's
Kieran
Gillen.
Hold on, now I need to Google this.
He's Irish.
Gillen.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay.
Kieran Gillen.
And the other one is Kieran Gillie.
Gillian?
Okay, see, you can see how I was confused. And let's not act like this is completely... Paul Scheer writes comic books, so, I mean, they can be multi-talented.
Wait, actually, it's Kieran Gillen. The only difference is A versus E in the last name.
Ah, see, I'm even closer. It's those damn Scottish names.
So anyways, that guy is not the person we're talking about, but I was getting him confused in a different way from Nick. I wasn't going to remember if he writes Darth Vader or Star Wars.
Mm.
I think he writes Darth Vader or I think it's just called Vader. And, Jason Aaron, I believe, writes Star Wars. And he also writes Thor, or what I think is called The Mighty Thor now. But it's the one with Jane Foster.
Gotcha.
Spoiler alert.
spoiler alert for a thing that happened last year. God, that's fine.
Yeah. but so I think that's probably why that's probably why Southern Bastards is kind of a slow roll.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually, maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself on the comic, but after I finished reading Volume 1, I like immediately wanted to read Volume 2, and I looked to see if I bought it on Kindle, and I went to see if Volume 3 was out, and it's not out yet, which made me a little bit sad.
That's really funny, because before we started recording, Jen and I were talking, and she did the same thing.
Yep. Like, immediately.
Yeah.
I didn't read the second volume, though, just so that I wouldn't spoiler, because I know I would want to.
Yeah, I held off on reading it as well, because, four issues, we usually talk about more than four issues, just because that's the way trades are published. But this one, I think, four issues, it was money well spent. It's pretty dense. And there's a lot to it. So.
Oh yeah.
So why don't we officially get started? So yeah, this is episode 247 of Welcome to Comics, and we read Volume 1 of Southern Bastards, which is titled Here Was a Man. The author is Jason Aaron, as I mentioned before, and the artist is Jason Latour.
And Karen Gillan is not involved in any way, shape, or form.
Not at all.
Nor is Karen Gillan.
Neither of them are from the southern United States, either.
They're from... Well, that's the interesting thing. Scotland is basically the southern... Or, obviously, it's north of England, but it is England's south. Old south, essentially. I'm going to get yelled at by English people who don't understand what I'm saying. I'm saying that, culturally speaking, the Scottish are similar to our southerners. There we go. That's a way of saying it. Except not racist. Just mean and cheap.
Karen Gillan, the writer, is not from Ireland, like I was saying. So, sorry about that. He says he's British.
That's somewhere. He could be Welsh. Oh, I hope he's not Welsh.
Oh, don't hate the Welsh.
It's like
his name, like, even though his name is, like, not, it's not obvious how to pronounce his name, it has some vowels in there, so I don't think he's Welsh. If he was Welsh, he would probably not have any vowels in his name.
Yeah, if he was true. Welsh, he would just be gargling rocks to speak is all, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that cute? Andy's still typing around in the document, even though he's not on here.
Yeah, aww. So... Also, to speak to what Nick just said, Andy is obviously not here with us again. He has a child, and he's taking care of it. He only has one, so, you know, it's pretty
it's
casual
easier.
In my book. I have two, and here I am. Sorry, Andy.
Well, your kids are much better. His kid is an unruly child.
Last night... We were originally planning to record yesterday, listeners, and one of the reasons why we didn't record was technical issues, from what I hear. But the other reason was because my child would not sleep, and I drove around for an hour with her in the car to make her go to sleep. Which is not the worst thing ever, but, you know, could have been doing something else.
Yeah.
Anyways, parenthood is... some kind of thing. But that's not what this comic is about. Well, it kind of is. I mean,
in a way.
There's some daddy issues in this comic.
Yeah. There's just a whole lot of issues. It's very dense, which is kind of hard to pull off because there isn't a whole lot of dialogue in this thing. There's a lot of atmosphere. Is the way I like to think of it. This one was interesting because, I've been on a couple of your guys' episodes now. Thank you very much. And so far, all of them have been nice, goofy things like X-Statics or Wu-Tang Clan or Marvel Apes or Super. And one other one, right? Oh, no, this would be the other one. Great.
This is the one other one.
Yeah. This is the one other one. And this is the one that completely is not up my alley in any way, shape, or form. This is the thing that I recommended it because I read this WonderCon. I recommended this when I read it at WonderCon on the way home. And, like, I was just sitting in the back seat and immediately threw it to the person in the passenger seat up front and told them to read it so that we could have something to talk about because it was just that damn good. That was my experience with it initially. And then, you know what? Coming back almost a year later and reading it again did not disappoint in the least. It is probably one of the best comics that I've read.
Yeah, Nick, I totally agree with you. I know we're kind of talking in general terms up front, which is, well, I guess we don't really have a set way of going about things, but I agree with you. This is one of the...
We do this like jazz.
Yeah.
Usually high and drunk.
Free-flowing. Stream of consciousness podcast.
Yeah.
But, I agree with you. This is one of the better comics I've read. Definitely in the last year, but probably ever.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think sometimes these kind of comics... Well, most of the time they're published, I think, by one of the smaller publishers.
Mm-hmm.
These more, I don't want to say, maybe, I think this comic is a personal comic for these two writers, both of them being, or the writer and the artist, both of them, are from the South. But, you know, these kinds of more, I don't know, personal stories, not personal to the writer, but, you're very up close to a a person. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I was gonna say. So I've been reading the individual issues, which have, you know, the letters section and then some words from the authors. And you're right. No, this is actually a very personal story to both. I'm looking at their names now because I don't know it offhand. A very personal story to both Jason Aaron and Jason Latour. They're both, as you say, they're both Southerners. And right up in the very beginning of the very first issue, they write, they each write about their experiences with the South and try to explain to the audience why they're writing this. And it's because they love the South, but they also hate the South at the same time. They hate it in only a way that somebody who truly loves it can hate it. And so this is their attempt really to work out some of those issues that they have with it. Like, Earl Tubb, the main character of this, he's essentially their stand-in, at least in the first four issues, on account of he was born there, he left, never had any interest in coming back, just like them, but always had to kind of defend it to outsiders, you know what I mean? Talk about good old home in Alabama, all that kind of stuff, and everyone have to deal with all the stereotypes and negative baggage that comes with it. And then to finally go back there and see just how truly awful it is, it attacks his nostalgia. And that's why he's so drawn to staying there and reforming it and making it a better place.
Right.
This is actually kind of an interesting dynamic too, because I feel like this is a feeling that a lot of Southerners talk about when they set work in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always mixed feelings. No one ever says like, oh, I love the South unequivocally, or I hate it unequivocally. It's always, you know, the sense of home, but also it's widely acknowledged, I guess, that it has a darkness to it.
Yeah.
And I've never been there. So, I mean, I couldn't guess one way or the other, but it's a running theme with almost every piece of media I've seen that features the South.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not from the South. I'm from California, live in California, but I've been to South Carolina. And I've been to southern parts of Missouri.
Oh, that's real country.
You know, I don't want to say it's like, I've been to Texas also, actually, but I think Texas is a little bit different from mm-hmm. the South that we see here in this comic. You know, it is a lot, it's very different from California. And, you know, the people's attitudes and things like that are different, but, you know, they're people just, the vast majority of people in the South are just people trying to, you know, living their lives and like, just like us here or you, listener, anywhere where you are, you're living your life within, you know, within the culture that is happening around you. And, you know, whether, I think a lot of us, whether it's conscious or not, we are informed by what's happening around us, mm-hmm. whether we like it or not, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what we see with these two, the two creators of this comic is there, and Earl, right?
I'll tell you though, there's a line in here specifically. It's when Earl goes to Boss's barbecue for the first time and meets up with Dusty Tutwiler, and Dusty's saying like, oh, I heard you left. I heard you went off to the big city. He's like, yeah, I went to Birmingham, which, you know, for us, it's we don't consider that the big city, but he's like, yeah. The city folk. And the thing is, I have a friend who actually went out to Charlotte, North Carolina, which is a fairly large city in North Carolina. He went out there for work. And the thing is, he's experiencing this now, himself, because people will not go to Charlotte. There are people who live about 10 miles away and they're like, oh, that's the city. I'm not going to go to the city. I'm going to stay here in tiny little Ashland, that sort of thing. And so there is a very big distrust. And actually, if you read the individual comics, you'll see in the letters column, testimonial after testimonial of reader who's saying, like, this is exactly like my town. It's so weird. There's a very big mistrust of anything that's considered other. And so if you are in a rural area like this, you consider, you know, even something as rinky-dink podunk as Birmingham, Alabama, at being the other, and therefore kind of threatening to you in Craw County. Or, in Dev's case, threatening to you in Charlotte, North Carolina.
That is so bizarre to me. I mean, coming from the Bay Area, where it's just, like, a huge mix of every kind of person. Like, the idea that you would be weirded out by someone from the big city. But, I mean, I think that's also what makes this comic appealing to me, because it shows me something that is utterly foreign. Like, I don't know, as I said, I don't know if this is what the South is like, but if it is, that's a really nuanced depiction.
Yeah. Well, for fairness sake, because I don't want Southerners listening to this thinking that we're Yankees just bashing on them, this is deep South. Like, one of the letters in the back, God, I wish you guys had read them. Some of them are really good. They're talking about how if you're driving along the interstate, any town you meet along the interstate, it's going to be fine. It'll be like, it'll be like driving through Lodi up here, you know, that sort of thing. But once you get off that interstate, once you go maybe 10, 15 miles inland, that sort of thing, into the backwoods, that's when you start to get these really insular towns. And to the point where something like this could, okay, this is clearly an exaggeration, right? Although loosely based on something that happened in the 1970s. So this is very clearly an exaggeration. There's no one man controlling the town in real southern towns, no matter how backwoods you get. But you could see how something like that could theoretically happen. Because it's so insular, one person who wields all the power, like in this case, the football coach, is able to wield an outsized influence over everyone else.
Yeah, and it's actually, I think the most telling how much power he has, because it can't be a very big town if every single person in the town, including the justice system, entirely fears a high school football coach.
Yeah. In high school, I was that afraid of the football coach, but that's just me.
It's kind of telling, too, of that the other trope that I think is often seen in Southern culture, which is football rules small towns, which again is bizarre to me, but it's something I see again and again. Like, if the football team wins and goes to state, it's a huge fucking deal. And apparently it's a big enough deal in this town that people are willing to let each other get killed over it.
Well, I feel like, because, and this is, all right, I mean, I've read more, but obviously I'm just going to base off of these first four issues. I actually kind of feel like it isn't so much we just want to win this game, and as long as we win, you can do whatever you want, coach. I feel more like they have lived in this for so long, this environment, that they don't question it at all, and they don't realize how negative it is or positive it is or whatever. And then as soon as this outsider comes in, Earl, who they perceive as an outsider even though he was born there, they perceive him as an outsider, and when he comes and starts saying, you know, like, hey, this is a pretty shitty place, and things are messed up, and all that kind of stuff, they get defensive about it. And it's like, okay, yeah, it's not good, but it's our not good. You know what I mean? If this is a shithole, but it's our shithole, and we're going to be the ones to clean it up if we decide to clean it up at all. I mean, that was my takeaway, at least. That's why, you know, towards the end, spoiler, whatever, we'll freeform this. When Earl is trying to rally the townsfolk outside of the barbecue, the townsfolks are the first ones to reject him, to throw a rock at his head and tell him to go back to Birmingham. It's not the people that are employed by boss, coach boss, rather. It's just the average people who are just like, you're an outsider and who are you to tell us what to do, city man? That sort of thing. At least, as I said, that was my interpretation.
Yeah, and you kind of get the sense, too, that, like, boss doesn't cross the line in terms of angering the town folk and who he kills, because, for instance, the first guy, who actually ends up dead, what was his name? Dusty.
Dusty, yeah.
You know, they're like, oh, he's a thief, he's a meth head, blah, blah, blah. Like, he has, quite a number of crimes that he's committed. And then the kid, it's explicitly stated, like, oh, this is, like, the 17th fucking child, no one wants him.
Yeah, because you're right about that, is, that was also what I gleaned from it, was that he rules with an iron thumb, and you eventually find out just how deep this whole thing runs, but to the common person, to just the average person on Main Street, it seems like the bad stuff that happens to people who deserve it. And this is also, this kind of is projecting, and there's a little bit in there, but this is also a very church-going, A causes B kind of, society, or city, whatever. So, if something bad happens to you, it's because you've sinned in some way, and then you brought it upon yourself. So when Dusty Tutwiler gets murdered, they see it as, well, I mean, he's a drug addict, and he sells meth, and he's not a very nice person. So clearly, whatever happened to him, he kind of deserved. Or that, and also folks just kind of mind their own business.
Yeah, and that's what gets me. Like, the fact that they can let a child get put in a hospital, and then watch someone get beaten in the middle of the street, or in the middle of a football field.
Yeah.
As the case may be. Like, I am a firm believer in objective morality, but at what point do you get to say, like, oh, it's totally cool to just murder children?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like they're probably in fear, but you're right. Like, at some point, you've got to realize, wait, because the thing is, I'll get a tiny bit into the next volume, just a tiny little bit, is that even though the coach doesn't really affect, everyone all that much, I'm sorry, certain individuals he affects a lot, and others he affects just a tiny bit, but the thing is, it affects everyone. So, if you're just sitting in your house going, oh, well, it doesn't really affect me all that much, I mean, I can deal with it. If you look at the sum total, it's like, at a certain point, people have to kind of wake up and realize that they need to do something about it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Going back to your point earlier, Nick, about why the townsfolk didn't react, I think that this is just, part of it is, you know, it's just their reality. And, you know, it's hard to, oftentimes it's hard to upset the status quo, right? And I think that's has a lot to do with, I mean, it sounds weird to me even to say this because it sounds like I'm defending the actions of the town or their inaction in, you know, in allowing these kinds of things to happen. But I think that's part of the reason, you know, it's their reality, and they are able to justify.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an old saying there's an old saying that fish don't have a word for water, because they live in it. They don't need a word. And so at the same time, these folks probably don't really realize how bad their situation is because they've lived in it for so long. And it's just become the new normal. And then that's why they react as strongly as they do when Earl starts to point things out, because he's starting to make them realize just how truly awful Craw County is.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know.
And yeah, it's heavy, right? Not a whole lot of jokes in this one.
Gotta realize, right?
Oh yeah, the sheriff knows for sure. I mean, they explicitly draw that conclusion in, I think, the second episode, maybe the second issue, I believe, when Earl goes to the sheriff and he says to him, he's like, hey, oh, so you played football? He's like, yeah, I was a running back for a little while. And then he just leaves. He's like, I know I can't convince you. You're probably in league with the coach and everything. I can't be here right now.
Oh, I meant, like, the sheriff seems like he's going to be the guy to have the moral flip here.
Oh, and be like, sorry, this is too fucked up.
I can't do it. Yeah. Because, I mean, you see him after Earl gets completely wrecked by the coach, and this look on his face, he's just like, oh, fuck, I let that happen in the middle of the street.
That was on my watch. Yeah.
Also, now here's a question. Is Earl dead? Because in the notes, Andy was like,
pretty dead.
He has a hole in his face. And my response is, have you not seen Fight Club?
It's funny you should ask that, because when I read it, I thought, okay, yeah, no, he's definitely dead, because that last sequence, they do the flashbacks to his childhood, interspersed with the actual fight, as they've done a couple times in these first four issues, which are beautiful scenes whenever they do. And then the last thing that he sees is that strike of lightning that strikes the tree to give him his stick of justice. And so to me, it was obvious, okay, this is how it has to end. Like, it has to end with him dying. The second person that read this, Kenneth, he was the one in the passenger seat, the unlucky person that had to read it immediately after me so that I could yell at them about how great it was. He thought that Earl was alive. And we talked about that for a while, and I was like, what? It's bizarre. I can't possibly see him as being alive. But then, yeah, you're asking too, so I guess it is kind of, and to get into some of the letters later on, don't worry, this is not plot spoiler at all. Some people, even as far as issue 12, still say the supposed death of Earl. So there are folks out there that are maintaining that he's alive somewhere, which is very interesting. But to me, yeah, there's a hole in his face that looks very bad. He must be dead.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I took away, that he was dead.
Yeah. I mean,
that's part of the tragedy for it, for me, especially when paralleled with when you finally find out who he's leaving phone messages for.
Oh, yeah.
My
was so thought beautiful.
Was that it was like an estranged wife or something.
That's... And,
you know, that's tragic in and of it. You know, that's tragic enough, but when you find out the reality,
yeah,
hit me pretty hard, you know?
That's interesting, because...
Yeah, that was heartbreaking.
When I read it, I was I thought, it crossed my mind, like, I bet you this is some art statement, and there's no one on the other end. So actually, when there was someone on the other end, I was very surprised. Did you have a thought on who it was when you were reading it, Jen?
I figured that it was a former lover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like David thought, but I also figured that it could be like a friend or something.
Yeah.
Like, you get the sense that he's a really lonely old guy, mm-hmm. and maybe he's just calling like his only friend.
Aw, that's sad.
Because
you think
if he had a living wife, she'd come and help him pack up his uncle's house.
Well, I didn't necessarily think it was, his wife. I thought it was, I thought it was like maybe he was separated from his wife.
Yeah.
And he was trying to make an effort to patch things up. And he was like just communicating with her. And that's why but she was still upset, so she wasn't picking up the phone or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, when he died, if it was an estranged wife who had come around too late, that's pretty sad. But to find out that it was not something like a bad situation, it was just that the person on the other line really could not, could not take the call, made it even worse. And it was like not a sad situation. I mean, it is a tragic situation, but
his daughter just, seems to
hit pretty hard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's because I see what you're saying. Like, it's tragedy if it's, you know, an estranged wife and she just now decides, okay, I can, let me call him back. That's tragedy. But it's truly sad if it's something completely benign in a way, like benign and realistic. Like, it's his daughter and she's just busy, you know, fighting a war in Afghanistan. And the thing is, as soon as she gets back, the first thing she does is return all those calls, and that's just, that is what really hits you in the gut. And I think, at least for me, the reason it hit so hard was because it wasn't something I had really seen in a comic before. Even though it's, you know, it's such a banal thing, it's very unheard of as, in a drama tragedy really like this.
Yeah, and I think too, it's, I mean, we have the running theme of Earl being estranged from his father. And we see that, we think that that's going to be replicated if it's a kid, right? Mm-hmm. Because, like, the calls aren't being returned. But then you see, no, they have a healthy relationship.
Yeah, he actually seems to have learned.
Like, yeah, like, he turned it around, and it's still fucked. And that yeah. is sad, because it's, like, just really ironic.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's it does mirror in a lot of ways. Like, he joined the Marines to get away from his dad. But it seems like, and this is conjecture because we don't have a whole lot to go based off of what we know about his daughter. We actually don't know much of anything about his daughter except that she exists. She is a Marine, though, and it seems to me that she joined to emulate her dad in a way Earl was almost forced against his will to emulate his dad in the end, you know, to fight against the Dixie Mafia and fall in its service. Although, actually, I shouldn't quite say that. We don't really know how his dad died, just that he was, he died youngish. That's all we really know. I learned the guy that this is loosely based off of, he died in a car accident, which is a lot less climactic. But, yeah.
Yeah, this is a better narrative than that.
Yeah. Yeah, this is much better than real life. Real life, he fights the Dixie Mafia. Buford Pusser, P-U-S-S-E-R, I don't know, fights the Dixie Mafia for a bit. His wife gets murdered. He kills some folks. His tenure as sheriff is over, and then he dies in a car accident a couple years after a movie's made after him. That's real life. Shit. That's boring. Yeah.
That's sad, though.
Yeah.
So sad.
Yeah. But this, oh god, it hits so hard. I know we keep saying that. like, it's kind of funny because that's really all that you can say about it. Just, this is very heavy, very atmospheric, very well done. But you keep hitting the same themes because ultimately that's what's true.
Yeah. And I feel like this is going to carry those themes throughout the rest of the series, because how can it not?
Mm-hmm.
Right there.
Yeah, it's not going to suddenly become a musical comedy.
Ingrained.
Yeah.
and so much of it too is lineage. Like, a lot of it is who is your father,
mm-hmm.
or who is your son. The only thing we know about Esau is that he's the preacher's son.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, we know he works for Coach Boss, but we don't know, is he currently on the football team? Is he, like, a former player? How does he know Coach Boss? We don't know shit about him.
Yeah.
And then, like, his friend who hangs out with him at the rib joint, I think we learn...
Materhead? I can't pronounce his name. M-A-T-E-R-H-E-A-D.
Materhead.
Materhead? Yeah, we'll go with that.
Yeah. I could not figure out if that was some kind of, like... insult or his actual name.
Yeah, which I kind of like. No, you're right. I wasn't sure for a long time either, and I kind of feel that works. You know what I mean? Like, he's that kind of, he's a very simple character. Like, I don't want to say he's developmentally disabled. He might be, or he may just be a football player who took a bunch of knocks to the head. That happens. But he is that kind of character who wouldn't know if people are making fun of him or not.
Yeah,
he's kind of a dum-dum, as we learned. But Esau is just, he is awful. Like, if you look through these first four issues, Matterhead seems to be a little bit cognizant of, hey, is this the right thing to do? You know, that sort of thing. But Esau just seems to revel in being just an awful human being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's clear it's a power trip for him.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're already supposed to know that we don't like this fellow. He
Correct.
Has, like, fucking Confederate flag tattoos. Yeah.
Rebel. Anybody who has a neck tattoo across the front of your neck, you generally kind of don't like them. But then also, the way we're introduced to him is he's just pissing in an open street, because he's a man full of piss, in the most literal metaphor I've ever seen.
And then he pees on a dog.
Yeah. Which, that dog was interesting. Because I have a lot of, I'm so bad at describing it, but I have a lot of feelings and thoughts about that dog, because he always shows up. I almost kind of feel like that is actually the author avatar. Like, that's the author commenting on the good and bad things about the South. Because it seems to show up in the strangest of places, whenever something distinctly Southern is going on. But then also to have Esau piss in that dog's face is like an insult to the good parts of the South. Like, there's no redeeming characteristics for this character. There's no way, like, these other folks, you can look at them and go, all right, well, maybe it's situational, maybe they're turning a blind eye out of fear, that sort of thing. But Esau is very definitely just a demon. And to the point where, I mean, he has it tattooed on his chest. You can see little devil horns peeking up on a little pentagram. Like, we are supposed to realize that this is a bad, bad dude. He is completely unredeemed, ugly white trash. I mean, he runs around in Zumbas, for God's sake. Zumbas and tap out gear. This guy is, yeah, he is every single person you've ever seen at Faces of Walmart. So I mean, that's the thing, is he's very distinct in what purpose he serves to the story. And so to have him basically be contrarian to that dog, means something. I really wish I had taken more English literature classes in school, but I didn't like it very much, so I'm doing this as an amateur. It's a symbol. What's this a symbol of? I don't know. I didn't get that far in class.
That's about as far as the classes go.
Good.
I made it through grad school, so there's that.
You're supposed to figure out what the symbol is on your own.
Yeah, that's your problem.
I think the dog, I think, to me, is like a harbinger. Like, the dog is a sign that something is going to happen. But it's not really clear what they mean exactly. Like, I'm kind of flipping through to see where parts where the dog appears. And a lot of them are not, you know, it's at the very beginning, the dog's taking crap on the side of the road. Yeah. And then there's a part where Esau pees on the dog. But there's also the right before Dusty, when he stumbles onto the football field, the dog is peering out from under a car or the bleachers. And then the dog also appears when Esau's gang, like, confronts
Earl.
Right after he leaves the sheriff's office. And the dog, you know, you see Earl walking back to his truck, and the dog is walking up kind of growling. And then, you know, this is one of the parts where he chooses not to fight them.
Right.
He gets in his truck and the dog is barking as he's leaving. So maybe the dog is like a stand-in for, I don't know, maybe the regular people.
Well, if you're,
because, you know, like, if, so the reason why it kind of makes me think that is for, especially the scene where, with the truck, where Earl's going back to the truck, is the dog first is approaching Earl growling, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's not necessarily, it's kind of a hostile approach, but it's like a warning, right? It's like, if you keep doing what you're doing, things could get worse. And then as Esau's posse shows up and he's running away, the dog starts to bark at him, like, maybe the dog is, you know, now that the dog is, you know, not, the dog is with its pack. It's brave. It's a lot braver now. And it's going to, you know, now that it doesn't have to face Earl one-on-one, it can raise its voice. But then thinking to the part where Esau pees on the dog, you know, he clearly looks down on the people of the town, the regular people. He gets really mad, kicks the dog, and then takes a piss on it, right?
I could see that, although, keep in mind, the final time we see the dog in this trade is at the very end. He attacks Matterhead and Esau as they're beating the shit out of Earl. And then as Earl beats the shit out of them.
So maybe the dog represents, like, is a stand-in for the conscious of the town, like the subconscious. Yeah. You know, early in the story, the town, even though they're being oppressed by people like Esau, they still want their town to maintain the status quo. And in this heated moment at the end where maybe the town's conscience realizes that Earl isn't the enemy and it is people like Esau. So the dog steps in. And then once, you know, after the fight's over and we see the phone ringing in Earl's pockets, the dog is sniffing him, you know, not being confrontational, and then just walks off.
I can see that.
I don't know.
I feel like the dog is what the town folks' morality either is or should be at the time. Because he's really fairly contradictory. Like when we first see him, he's crapping on the side of the road, but it's in front of all these signs for churches. And I feel like that's kind of a really strange juxtaposition, yeah. Like a shitting dog and like signs for the Baptist church. And I mean, they keep saying, oh, these are God-fearing church-going people. Well, apparently not enough.
No, yeah.
Well, there are other contradictions like that too in other parts of the town.
Yeah.
There aren't that obvious. Like there's one character when Earl is making an appeal to the townsfolk right before they throw the rock at him. There's a guy with a crucifix around his neck, but he's also standing outside drinking a beer in public, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a Sunday, right?
Yeah.
And they comment on that, too, like, oh, he's doing this on a Sunday, as though apparently these people, you know, care that it's the Sabbath, but not really. But, I mean, like, the townsfolk aren't actually God-fearing people in the sense that it's generally meant. We see the dog, you know, finally turning on Esau, which I think is meant to also be, like, perhaps the murder of an old man
in front of everyone
is going to be a moral turning point for the town. Because it's kind of hard to let something like that slide when it happens directly in front of you.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the main difference between Dusty and Tad. Those both happen behind closed doors or in the woods. And it's a lot harder to deny, you know, the morally right thing to do when you don't have to look it in the eye.
Yeah. When you see it, yeah, in front of you instead of just hearing about it through rumor.
Yeah. It's like that acronym. What's that acronym? NIMBY. Not in my backyard. It's that kind of
thing, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It is. I mean, it is kind of happening in their backyard, but it's like, you know, they're not... It's not happening directly to them,
right? When it happens to someone else, you know? Like Dusty or Tad, you can say, "Well, they did something to deserve it." But when they see this man come up and pick a fight, you know, try and clean up the town, that sort of thing, like his daddy did before him, they see that and they realize, okay, this guy hasn't done anything wrong. In fact, great wrong has been done to him. And then he gets basically murdered right in front of their faces. You can't just let that slide. Alas.
Although I will say, with all the emphasis on, like, patrilineage, is that a word?
Yeah.
Well, it's a word now.
Oh, no, it's a word.
Okay. Patrilineage, everyone's like, oh, your daddy was an asshole.
Yeah.
And it's almost like people hate him because of who his father is.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is, what kind of asshole, really, based on what we see, what asshole was his dad? He was just a sheriff who was fighting the Dixie Mafia. Like, but it's said by the person who says that is Dusty Tutwiler, who is himself, you know, a part of that crime syndicate. And so, I mean, that's the thing, is people hated old man Tubb, what's it, Bert Tubb. They hated him because he was an authority figure who was trying to tell them what to do and what was right and what was wrong. And I think ultimately that you might even, yeah, you know, I think you're definitely right about the dog being at least the conscious or the collective unconscious of the town, because that dog is a wild, mangy animal, but it has a sort of I kind of want to say it almost has a sort of nobility in its of itself. You know what I mean? Because it is a wild animal. It's not pretending to be civilized. It is what it is. And these people, they are that defiant. They're, as I said before, a couple minutes ago, this is a shithole, but by God, it's their shithole, and they're the ones who made it that way, and they're the ones who are going to live in it that way because it's theirs, and nobody can tell them what to do. Whether that's right or wrong, that's a whole other statement. And I can give you an opinion, but it doesn't really matter.
The thing about the dad, though, is I think he did more wrong than fight the Dixie Mafia, because Earl was estranged from him. He said that he left to go to Vietnam and did not come back for 40 years until his father's funeral. If your dad's a hard ass, but like you have an okay relationship, you probably speak over the course of 40 years. I think, and Earl doesn't seem to be a bad person. He seems like a fairly upstanding guy. The only thing I can think of is, so you get the sense that Earl's daughter is half black, and in this one scene where he's getting the crap beaten out of him, and we see the flashbacks, you see that he's making love with a woman. And I'm wondering if his father didn't like the race relations going on there, and was not friendly to the idea of an interracial marriage.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be it, but, like, that's really guessing, right?
Yeah.
I don't... There's got to be some deeper reason why Earl would not talk to his father ever again after leaving for Vietnam. Because that's not normal.
I just assume, like, well, I just assumed that, because his dad, we see, dies in 1972, so I almost feel like there just wasn't time for it, because the Vietnam War was, well, we don't know when he entered, but, oh, actually, we could back figure it out, because, never mind, that would be spoilers. I said nothing. We could...
Wait, was it 72 and his dad died?
Yes, his dad's tombstone shows him 1972, so there may not have been enough time. And then, I mean, if you figure that's the only thing tying him really to that area, and he's always felt like an outsider anyway, that that's a very good reason to just never come back. But we don't know what year he left for the war. Ostensibly sometime in the late 60s, so it's very probable that that his dad just died before he got home. But as I said, okay. I don't know for sure.
I took it as the 40 years he didn't speak to his dad, but it's not that. So
yeah.
There goes that theory.
He died. He actually died pretty young too. If you notice, I think he was in his early to mid 40s.
I think 49. Yeah,
49,
which, yeah, is pretty...
Yeah. Pretty young. Well, okay, that was back when you would eat a pound of bacon for breakfast and then wash it down with a six-pack of beer. So he probably wasn't in the best of health, but at the same time, that's still fairly young.
Ooh, this is interesting. I'm just kind of flipping through all the scenes where he's talking about his dad, and the first time he tries to chop down the tree, he calls his daughter, and he says... The longer I'm here, the more I remember why I left this place and never came back. It's more like him than ever now. The whole damn town. It's like he seeped into the water supply when he died. I'm wondering if... So we know that his dad fought off people.
Yeah.
We don't know why. And I kind of wonder if maybe his dad was... not the avatar of justice that he's portrayed as at times. Although Earl does later tell the current sheriff, the good-for-nothing one, like, well, at least he did his job. So.
Yeah. It's no, you're right. There isn't a whole lot of background in this part. And really, you don't get much more. You get a little bit more background later on as we go along. But at this point, you know, that's a distinct possibility, and that would be a very good reason for him to just decide to up and leave, like, I want no part of this, Dad, that sort of thing, if that's the case. So, I mean, that's as valid a theory as anything. Yeah, that's interesting.
And I want to read more of this.
Oh, yeah.
I need to know.
It's only going to last an hour.
Maybe the dad ran the town in a way in a, you know, similarly to Coach Boss, but the dad did it through through rule of law. Maybe he was too much of a dictator type of figure, and that's why people didn't like him. And so Earl sees similarities to that with Coach Boss, but you know, his dad, the reason he can say at least my dad did his job, but maybe his dad didn't cross a line and do illegal things.
Yeah. Well, I can
just he upheld the law to such a high degree that it became oppressive.
Yeah.
Which is how the situation is with Coach Boss, right?
Yeah.
People are being oppressed.
Yeah.
And the coach does say that the town was jubilant when the father died.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
And now it's maybe the pendulum has swung the other direction, right? People are more free to do what they want. But with that freedom, there are people who are taking it to the other extreme. And that's the people, that's Coach Boss, or maybe not Coach Boss, but the people who are his underlings, right? Who are doing the actual dirty work. Right. Right?
Well, it's like, it's like the end of Back to the Future 2, essentially, when they get back to 1985 and it's run by Biff Tannen. It's that sort of thing where there is no law, essentially. No law other than do as thou will. That sort of thing. And that's just as oppressive. Like, that amount of freedom is as oppressive as somebody telling you, this is the law, do this, this, that, the other thing. Being an authoritarian in the other direction.
Yeah, it's just as bad. And, I mean, I think that we see that it shifts, like, you know, Coach claims these things for himself. You know, he says, my county, my town, my stick.
My football team.
Yeah.
You can tell which is the most important. Yes. Like, well, that's he seems to just want power for the sake of having that power.
Well, you kind of get the sense it's a personal vendetta, too, because Earl, at the end, remembers, this is what starts, like, the epic old man fight. Earl's like, oh, you're the scrawny kid that I wouldn't let on the team. And you get the sense that there was this power dynamic, and that Coach Boss is just kind of enacting this personal vendetta from 50 years ago.
Yeah, Coach Boss.
That's crazy.
Yeah, Coach Boss is basically that kid who was bullied his entire life, and then as soon as he becomes in a position of power, now he's going to be the one, instead of learning from it and becoming a better person and whatever, he's like, nope, now I'm just going to be the one who does all the bullying.
Yeah, it's the same thing over and again, and he seems to acknowledge that and just not give a shit, which is, I think, one of the darkest parts of this.
Yeah. He's almost nihilistic. He cares about football, and he says that a couple times. He's like, I just do the football. I don't care about anything else. Even though, clearly, he does. He just is fairly nihilistic. Like, he's just going to do whatever he can because why not? I can do it. This is my town, my stick. That's the thing at the end there. He's like, you know what? This is my stick now. I want it. It's mine. I take it, I'm going to smash your face with it, and that's mine.
Yeah, I mean, the title of this comic is apt. That's all I can say.
It is. It is. These are the worst bastards you'll ever meet. Every single person, like, other than Earl and, his daughter, there really aren't any good people in this thing.
That's true. And Earl's a bastard, too.
Yeah, that's how
I was going to say. You don't beat people with a stick unless you're a goddamn bastard.
Because if you really, like, he could go back to Birmingham and say, you know, here's what's happening in Crock County. And people, proper authority figures could do something about it potentially. But Earl decides to,
take matters into
shoot at people with sticks.
He'll take matters into his own hands, you know, like his daddy.
Well, you know, I think when he hits Esau with the fry basket, in that instance, I think what he did was maybe acceptable because somebody he knew was being beat up. He was being threatened with a gun, and Earl steps in and saves him.
Yeah, it's not like he could have gone then, to get help, so yeah, you're right.
Yeah, but then later he returns with the stick, or when he gets the stick, he doesn't choose the stick. The tree chooses him. It gives him the stick,
mm-hmm.
right? He doesn't seek it out. He tries to destroy what's left of it, and he is chosen. He could choose to throw the stick down and continue on his way, but he decides that it's kind of thrust upon him, or that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, he sees it as a holy mission, almost.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. Like he even says that as he's... when he finally encounters Esau and his gang, he says, you know, I don't know why I got this stick, or whatever. It's something like, I don't know why I got this thing, but whatever happens from here on out, I'm glad I got it. And so he sees this as almost, yeah, a holy mission.
He's the once in future Southern bastard. But, I mean,
he
really,
pulled the stick
like
from
Excalibur,
the tree. Yeah.
Right? Like, it's just like, here, take it.
Yeah. I like also, I mean, you can see how dumb Matterhead is. He's like, you think it's the same one? It's like, obviously it's not the same one. The old one was signed by multiple people and buried with his corpse. It obviously is not the same stick. But here he is, this superstitious, kind of silly, magical thinking guy thinking, you think it's the same stick?
Maybe that coach boss is what's his name? Is it Galahad? The one who returns it's Lancelot, right? He returns the sword?
That's
what he's trying to do. He's trying to put the sword back.
All I learned about Camelot, I learned from Once Upon a Time, so I don't know.
Well, like my image of Camelot is the movie Excalibur from 1982.
Oh, also First Knight. So Richard Gere must have done it. Yeah.
Oh, First Knight's not bad.
Oh, that movie's great.
Anyways,
it's very shiny armor.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways, Jen, what are you gonna say, Jen?
Total tangent. Materhead is on Urban Dictionary.
Serious?
It has equal heads up, or thumbs up and thumbs down. So I don't know, but it says a nickname of a country boy from the Deep South.
That's it?
The name was passed down father to son. There is only two Materheads that are still alive today. Of course, this is from an entry by someone called Materhead the Second. So who the fuck knows?
He'd be the authority.
he would know.
He very well would be. Yeah, I mean, I guess perhaps it's a nickname, like an actual nickname. I really like the five words related to Materhead. Country boy that carries a big fucking stick is first on the list, followed by ladies' man, redneck, southern pimp, and southern player.
None of which
educational moment of the day.
None of which really fit to this guy, right? He's not smooth in the
so
least.
Much.
No.
So, what did you guys think of the art for this comic?
I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's ugly. The faces are ugly. And it's meant to be, I think. Like, these are not pretty, glossed over people. They do not look nice. They look old and wrinkly, and they grimace, and they look beat the fuck up sometimes. The Hicks look super hickish. And I don't know, it's just like, it fits perfectly.
Yeah. I like also that the coloring is very washed out. Very, I don't want to say sepia tone, but you know what I mean? It's very dried out. Like, it looks old and weathered and beaten.
Yeah, I think I totally agree. The people and the town and everything looks like it's just been out in the sun too
long. Yeah. It really fits the theme, or the theme. It really complements what's being talked about in here.
Also, all the men except Esau have the same freaking haircut.
And Esau has that weird-ass hybrid mullet.
The mullet, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, when I say they look hickish, I mean, they all have that, like, fade haircut going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a bunch of people have buck teeth. Yeah. Or their teeth are yellow. No one has white teeth.
Yeah. Yeah. They very definitely went for a realistic, well, we say realistic, we know it's not that bad. It's okay, Southerners, don't come up at us. We know you're cool. But they went for that sort of, that feel, that grungy, grimy, rusty feel. Everything looks old. Like the houses, Earl's house, you can tell it was made 100 years ago and it's just been patched over and whitewashed and painted up to look better, to present a nice front, like, oh, this is a happy home, but you know it's all beaten up and dilapidated.
Yeah, and I mean, they play on stereotypes a lot here, I think, with what the people and the places look like. And even the dog. The dog looks, like, so fucked up.
Yeah.
But
that's a dog. You're gonna need some shots.
Yeah. That dog is, like, clearly rabid.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we don't know he has but he's clearly rabid. But when you're writing an allegory to tell people about the spirit of a place and the tone of it, I think that stereotyping works well, because what you're basically doing is taking a perception that's had by the whole world around it and then showing people that, but then giving it some degree of nuance, mm-hmm. so that they can see, like, you know, this is kind of a distilled version of it. It's not, these aren't realistic people. They're caricatures of bad people.
Mm-hmm. But real Southern bastards.
Yeah. And obviously, you go to the South, you're not going to meet, like, every single person there is not going to beat you to death with a stick. So,
especially not in front of a crowd. Like, we got, I know we've said that many, many times, but it is the climax of this thing, is he is beaten to death with a stick in front of the entire town, who came to watch and see what would happen.
Yeah, like,
like, it was entertainment.
This is not... You know, they say so much about Southern hospitality, and I assume they don't mean this. But
well, it's just like, I forget which of the Jasons it was, but one of them wrote a neat thing about how Southerners are incredibly gracious and hospitable. Like, they will give you, if you are broken down by the side of the road, they will go out of their way to get your car working and get you back on the road so that you can get the fuck out of there, you stranger.
That's weird.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it, when you take a stereotype and then add actual character and flavor to it, mm-hmm. that's, I think, how you get an interesting, distilled version of a place, especially when you're working with allegory. It doesn't have to be realistic. These don't have to be real people. They're trying to not show you what the South is. They're showing you a facet, like the darkest, dirtiest, most primal facet of the South.
Yeah, they're starting with those stereotypes because the comic book audience is largely West Coast and New York, West Coast and Mid-Atlantic and urban in general. We're not, like, there aren't too terribly many. There are definitely comic book reading people in the South. Again, I don't want you to yell at me. Please don't yell at me, South. I love you. I love your sweet tea. I love your fried chicken. But it's so us as readers and consumers, we're looking at this thing and we see these stereotypes and we're like, oh, yep, all right, that's what I imagine. But then by characterizing them and fleshing characters, hard to say, but by fleshing these characters out and giving them motivations and things on top of all that, you are transcending those stereotypes.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
It's a good place to start. Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, people always say how terrible stereotypes are, and that's true for the most part, but they're terrible because people stop at the stereotype. You know what I mean? They go, oh, you are this type of person, therefore here's all this other stuff, and then they assume that's true. That's a good place to start. Like, you can look at sociological stuff about stereotyping, and they concur. It's a good, useful social tool as a starting ground, but if you take it as gospel, or if you try and enforce those stereotypes, then you're a defective human being.
Yeah, and, yep. I mean, I don't think that this comic stops at the stereotypes in any way.
Right.
Which I think is what makes it good, because if I wanted to watch a bunch of stereotypes about the South, I would just watch, like, all the Simpsons episodes with Cletus. So.
Or the one where they actually go to live in the South for a little while.
Oh, I don't remember that one.
Oh, that one's great. I forget why. It's like witness relocation or something like that. They witness towards the end of the episode, they watch a Civil War reenactment where Lee slaps Grant and declares himself the winner of the war.
Okay.
It was one of the best episodes I can remember, but yeah. But yeah, no, I get your point. Like, I mean, that's the thing. If you want stereotypes, we've got that in spades. And this is one of the few things that I can think of where the South is actually portrayed in a nuanced light. Like, yeah, alright, they're not enviable people. These are, after all, the title is Southern Bastards. But you can see where they come from and why it's this way. And therefore, it does transcend that stereotype, at least to me. Now, if you're from Oklahoma and you read that, you might get offended. But judging from the people who wrote letters it's saying how much they love this thing, I think there weren't very many people who were offended by it.
Either that or they only published the fan mail.
No.
Oh, really?
Clearly, no. There are zero people. Actually, in fairness, I feel like they probably, they're very upfront about their Southern heritage and trying to explain to people why they're putting these things in there. So I feel like if there was negative feedback, they would have addressed it in some way or another. And if you read the individual episode, God damn it. If you read the individual issues, you'll get a better sense of that. I can't remember how the collections work out, if they have that or not, though.
I will have to look into that, because the Kindle ones are just the trades, and aww. I'm sad that I missed out on all that extra content.
There's a...
Yeah, it had the...
Did it have the recipe?
Little introductory notes. Yes, it has... the recipe.
Okay, so you get some of it, but yeah, you don't get like the monthly letters column, so yeah.
No.
Yeah. Right. But hey, you get that fried apple pie recipe, and you get that introductory this is what the South is really like, people, kind of thing, so you get most of it.
Okay. Well, should we rate this?
I'll go first. I'm gonna give this, man, this is really good. I'm gonna give it a 4.5. I thought it was, you know, it's just a great story, you know, we talk about it so much, I'm not sure how to reiterate what we said. You know, it's you know, for only 4 issues, it's really, there's a lot in it, and it's very emotional, I guess is one way to put it. It's tragic, but the characters are very compelling, and, you know, they're all, even the protagonist is a bastard. So, you know, the title is so very apt. I don't know what else to say. If you're listening to this, you already heard what I said in the rest of the issue. So yeah, 4.5. It's really good. Read it if you haven't already.
I'm also going to give this a 4.5. It's pretty rare that I just immediately go get the next trade or issue of something, and I really am looking forward to finding out what happens next. Mm-hmm. So I think they did a great job of crafting an interesting narrative. And no, I don't really like any of the characters, but I'm not sure that I have to like this story, which is, I think, a really nice aspect of the writing. To show despicable people doing despicable things, or even good people doing some despicable things, because I don't agree with everything Earl does either. But that doesn't mean that I can in any way put this comic down. I have to keep reading it. It's just that interesting. So, yeah, 4.5. I really like this, and you know, if we ever revisit this in the future and read more, maybe it'll be a 5, hopefully.
Cool. Yeah, I will go ahead and give it a 5. I really, really love this one, and it's not my usual cup of tea, I mean, as we've established. It's just, it's so, such a well-constructed story, and it, there's no dragging, it doesn't, any place where it does seem to drag a little bit, it's because it's the South and everything's a little bit sleepy there. Wow, that is, I'm going to blame the fact that it's 10:45 and I'm very tired that I said that. Let me rephrase that. Things move a little bit more slowly down there, and it's, like, it's an incredibly humid, oppressive place. And so it gives you that atmosphere whenever there's nothing going on. Those 3 or 4 times in the book where they intersperse flashbacks with what's going on right now are just some of the best imagery that I've seen in a comic, pretty much ever. And it, granted, it helps. I don't read serious stuff too much, so I'm not burnt out on it. But yeah, I would definitely give this a solid 5.
Excellent.
Nice.
So one more thing, Andy put his rating and a blurb in, so I'm going to go ahead and read this.
Oh, groovy.
This is exactly what Andy wrote in the notes, so yeah, here he goes. Andy's rating. Andy gave it a 4, and here's what he had to say. What bought me into this was the line from Earl. I know you're good people, church-going people, and then he gets murdered in front of them. As somebody who comes from an extremely religious community, this hit home. I knew a lot of very religious, spiritual people who were fucking assholes. Emphasis Andy's. And they didn't see any discongruity between their religion and their dickheadedness. So yeah, fuck all the people in this comic. Earl too. Don't go back there. Fuck that place. Let it rot and die. Anybody worth a damn, get out. And fuck this comic for doing such a good job at provoking an emotional response. Well fucking done. 4.
Roll Tide.
So, you know, even though Andy couldn't join us, he made sure to add his rating in there.
He had an awful lot of feels.
So, yeah. He certainly did. So, that's our opinion about Southern Bastards Volume 1, Here Was a Man, by Jason Aaron and Jason Latour. This episode is running really long, so I'm going to make an executive decision, and we're going to skip our trivia, which is the second week in a row, but I know many of us are falling asleep in front of our microphones. So, yeah. So, you know, thanks for listeners for joining us for another episode. And Nick, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been fun.
For these last three
episodes. Yes, thank you.
It's, it's always a pleasure having you on the show, and, you know,
if, I'm sorry I murdered you a couple months ago.
That's okay.
You guys got better. It's fine.
Yeah, we got better. Yep. You know, hopefully we can tap you again to do some episodes with you. Because, you know, like I said, I enjoy having you on the show.
Cool.
It's always good to have other people than just hearing ourselves talk all the time. But yeah, that's it. So, you know, like I said, thank you, Nick. Thank you, listeners, for your continued, listening to us talk about stuff.
And thank you especially to people who donate on patreon.com/welcometocomics. There you go. I did that for you.
Yes, thank you for that plug, Nick.
I got that.
So, next week on the schedule, we're gonna be switching gears back to, you know, back to Capes. We're going to do a short series on the Thunderbolts.
Okay.
So we're going to start with, Thunderbolts Classic Volume 1 by Kurt Busiek and Peter David. Then we're going to do Thunderbolts Faith in Monsters by Warren Ellis. And we're going to finish up that with Thunderbolts Cage by Jeff Parker, which I assume is probably the part where Luke Cage is in charge of the Thunderbolts. But, you know, join us next week and the 2 episodes after that to hear more about the Thunderbolts. Thanks very much, and goodbye.
Goodbye. Roll Tide. Goodbye.